Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahadiryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Vatitamastu, Vavishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
That was awful. Wilma, you started at your because my pitch is just so I can't get up there with this rough voice.
Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
That's nice. Thank you. Hi Anne. Hi Maria. Hi Viruja. Welcome. Dave says hi everybody.
Hi Dave.
No, that's David. This is Dave Herman. He's been online for a while, but we haven't met him yet. That is coming. You won't meet him at this camp, but he's going to come at the one of the camp I'm doing for CIS students. He's going to come to that. Okay. Are these questions or old questions? Let's see.
Some new questions.
Some new questions? Okay.
Was there a holdover from last night? Was there a question you said you'd do later?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Donna's question.
Oh, yeah. I didn't turn it in.
No.
Have you got it?
Oh. That's not it.
Okay. It was from the previous night, wasn't it?
I answered this: if such it is the witness, it is an attribute of Brahman. Part of Nitya, I did that. How can we humans get to know knownness? I did that. Oh, this is Rick's. I did this one too. If there is no true division between inner and outer, what accounts for my perception that I can raise my hand or direct my thoughts while the leaves in the wind outside move as they will? That one,
we went
through that.
And it's been answered in the text since then as well.
That's right, it has, absolutely. So your question was timely. I don't know which one it was. This doesn't seem to be it. Well, these are the two that I have. It wasn't those. We did those. What? Okay. Oh, let's try this one. On the one hand, it's not enough to merely intellectually understand I am the Atma. We need to genuinely experience it. On the other hand, seeking an experience of the Atma brings into the delusion of the Ahankara. What is the right way out of this? Catch 22. Okay.
Mine as well. I forgot to write my name on it.
Oh, okay,
good. Remember the catch 22 that you use.
That's a good question.
All right, well, there's a couple of things I think that will help clear this up. If you say, on the one hand, It is not enough to merely intellectually understand I am the Atman. We need to genuinely experience it. Right? That's what it says.
Yes.
Okay. This is the thing. The experience of the Atma is already there because the Atma is self-evident. So there is no need to experience it. This experience is constant. It's immutable. It never changes in any way. So it's the constant, self-evident experience of me, of the ultimate subject, the non-objectifiable subject. The non-objectifiable subject is the me, the conscious being that can't be objectified. Where all of the upadis that will take an ahankara and I notion are objectifiable, and that fact that we can realize that we that we are aware of the body, for instance, that we see the body, we hear the body, we can sit there and be totally aware of the body as an object, we can watch the body change, feel the body change. So the body is actually something that is objectified by all five sense organs. And so once I can objectify the body, and then I have to look at, well, who is the subject that is objectifying the body? And that becomes the sense organ. So now the body that had gained the superimposition of my being, that superimposition is broken because I've objectified the body and differentiated from the subject. So the me, the non-objectifiable me, had been taken by the mind to be the body, to be the sense organs, to be the mind. That's the problem of the buddhi, that superimposition that is there. So the self that you are is already that me that you are, this conscious being that I identify as me, as myself. That is already fully experienced. So the experience is not the problem. It's not about gaining an experience of me. It is removing the self-ignorance by objectifying everything that has been superimposed on me. So it's like stripping off the clothes one layer at a time, until what is just left is me in my own right. So that is not a problem of gaining an experience. It's a problem of stripping out off of me all of the things that I have superimposed on the self-evident experience of me. The me remains the same. Whether the me that myself is identified with the body, it's still the same self. Whether it's improperly superimposed on the body, if it's superimposed on the mind, it's still the same me that is now taken to be the mind. So I have to objectify all these conditioning adjuncts and recognize the to be able to differentiate the subject from the object, leaving the self experience to be free of the superimpositions. The self-experience never changes. It's self-evident, it's timeless, it's something that's non-objectifiable, so it's free of time and space. And so it's true that no type of just intellectual, theoretical type of knowledge is not going to be very helpful when you're right here. You are right here, so the knowledge itself has to be direct and immediate. And so it's not, you know, which is something of a problem with the Ramakrishna mission and what we call Neo-Vedanta. It's, you know, listen to sermons and lectures on the self, and then a lecture, you know, intellectual lecture, and then go meditate on it. That's problematic. That's kind of the whole Vivekananda era, the Ramakrishna, that tends to be their pedagogy. In fact, Anantanand Ram Bachchan, who's a professor, you know, I forget the name of it, the university, is a professor at somewhere in the Midwest. He wrote a book, wonderful book called Limits of Scripture, which taught limits of Scripture. And that talks about all of the Neo-Vedanta pedagogies, which are really problematic because they're in the Vedanta is not being handled as a pramana to give direct, immediate knowledge. So neither is it about gaining an experience. You know, that's the gain of the experience is not what it's about, because the experience is not is already is not the, is already there, so you're not going to gain an experience. It's about recognizing yourself that is already there. Right? And it's also being just intellectual, that's not going to help either. Because you can't have an intellectual knowledge of yourself when you're here. You need a direct, immediate recognition of what is here. Does that answer it?
Yes.
Okay. The ahankara is actually, it keeps moving in. You know, for instance, when you do the drik drisha viveka, you start out with the notion, that notion that you are the body. And so the ahankara has landed on the body in this particular prakriya. Then when you recognize that, well, your sense organs are aware of the body as an object. So the sense organs now become the subject of knowledge, of the nourisha. The nourisha is with the sense organs, and the object is the body. So now the ahankara has moved in one, leaving the body as a vishaya, as an object, not as the self. So now the ahankara is with the sense organs. Then you realize, well, the sense organs themselves are objectified, and they are known by the mind. So now the ahankara moves in one more notch. And the mind becomes the aham, actually the ahankara. But then you realize that the mind itself is known, is objectified. And then the sakshi becomes the aham. And then the sakshi, when the sakshi is analyzed, you realize, well, there's no body there, there's no mind there, there's no sense organs there for the self to be a knower. It's actually just conscious being. It is the self-evident knownness itself. And that's the atma. Because you can't go beyond that. There's no way to objectify that. There's nothing behind it. You don't need another consciousness to illumine consciousness. Consciousness is consciousness. That would go into an infinite regress. Some little something or other of consciousness is illumining some other little thing of consciousness. That's ridiculous. There's nothing behind consciousness. Consciousness is just conscious being. And that's it. Everything else is objectified, exists in time and space, is subject to birth and death, is infinitely divisible, and also is infinitely dividable. Divisible in terms of time, it's divisible in terms of space. It comes into being, it goes out of being, it can have no being of its own. And many different prakriyas we use around this to show the mityatva of the creation. Consciousness, conscious being is self-evident, so doesn't need mind. So, when in meditation, when turning the mind to appreciate the me, is the mind appreciating chittabhasa, or is it appreciating that there is self-experience that doesn't need mind to be experienced? Yes, let's see. Okay, let's take it sentence by sentence. Conscious being is self-evident, so it doesn't need mind. So I would get a little bit more. So it doesn't need the mind to experience it. The mind is not necessary. The universe is not necessary to experience consciousness. For you to experience consciousness, do you need your mind to turn around and say, oh, look, there's some consciousness? That is not necessary. Consciousness is self-evident because it's consciousness, it's its own experience. So even without the universe, without the body-mind sense organs, without any duality, consciousness is still me. Its own self-evident experience. Doesn't require anything. Okay. So, when in meditation, when turning the mind to appreciate the me, is the mind appreciating chittabhasa? Okay. Now, the reason when we do these meditative exercises, like ones that we've been working on lately, especially in reference to the text that we're doing, is because the mind is the one, we'll say buddhi, okay? The buddhi is the one that has the self-ignorance. Right? The buddhi is the one that is suffering from this anyonya adhyasa, this mutual superimposition. And the buddhi is the one that has to recognize that it is mithya, that it has no independent being, that it is objectified by consciousness, that it is continually changing, each vritti comes into being and goes out of being. All of these things with the teaching the buddhi recognizes about itself. When the buddhi recognizes that actually everything about it is objectifiable, right? Every thought, every emotion, if we take the antakarana just as a whole, the whole mind, every thought, every emotion, every imagination, whatever type of vritti is there in the mind is objectifiable. There is a subject-object relationship. And upon analysis, which can be effectively done in teaching as well as in meditation, in guided meditation, and then something which you do on your own when you contemplate, the recognition of the recognition of my being, the satchit, the conscious being free of time and space, recognizing experientially that time is objectifiable, that space is objectifiable, that qualities are objectifiable, experiences that change, that are subject to change, that exist within time, are objectifiable. Now, I realize that because all of them are known. Subject-object relationship. I know them. Okay, that's how we talk. That I know them. I'm actually attributing here knowership to the Atma. So we call that initially the Sakshi, because I'm used to knowing things. I know this. I know that. Ah, I know my mind. Yes, I know my mind because my mind is known. Right? I know that wall because the wall is known to me. The wall is known to me, so I know the wall. The thoughts are known to me, so I know the thoughts. It's language, you see that? But the mind is known to me, not because I know it, but because it is known, reflecting itself, the nature of my self-evident being, which is knownness. So knownness with the mithya vritti, which has no being of its own, that vritti is known, right? Because the nature of myself is known, is self-evident. So in the self-evident, when there's a vritti, that vritti has for its being self-evident awareness. And so the self-evident awareness is self-evident, is known, it's language. And so the vritti is known. When that vritti is gone, then whatever comes next is known. Because its adhishtana is known as consciousness. Is known as like a synonym just for self-evident, or a synonym for consciousness itself. In the sense that as though synonym for consciousness. If I get rid of the whole universe, what is left is this me, the Atma. I am me, the self-evident Atma. I am known by my swarupa, by my nature, not by a knower-known relationship. So it'd be like, oh, the whole universe is gone, I'm still here, without you saying any words. That's self-evident. And so if you have a vritti, which is mithya, that vritti has no being of its own. The being that it enjoys is simply the sat-chit, the sat-chit-atma. The sat-chit-atma is self-evident, so the vritti is known, so the vritti is known. And so this idea of a knower is something that resolves into pure consciousness. But as we do this drisha, the seer seeing differentiation, you know, the ahankara keeps dropping until I become first the sakshi, and then I recognize the sakshi is not really a sakshi. It's just pure consciousness. Now, well, let me make sure I'm still on track here. So when in meditation, when turning the mind to appreciate the me, is the mind appreciating chittabhasa? Vidyaranya uses the term chittabhasa. And it's a complicated term. It's useful, but it's at the same time complicated. Because it gives the sense that you, or the mind, is the reflection of consciousness. That your experience gives the notion, the idea, that your experience of consciousness is the reflection of consciousness. See what I mean? And then, so then there's a little consciousness, which is kind of the reflection of consciousness, and that reflection of consciousness has to, they use this kind of talk, has to merge into the big consciousness. Gives that type of a notion. But we don't really accept that, that there's this chitta-bhasa between, oh, chitta-bhasa means the reflection of consciousness, the abhasa, the reflection of consciousness. So we do use language. There's two theories. There are two different types of drishtantas that we use in order to kind of be able to help understand what this is. One is called the pratibimbavada. The other one is called avachedavada. Vada means the perspective. In talking about the relationship between consciousness and the mind, if we're using the pratibimbavada, pratibimba means reflection. And so the mind reflects consciousness. Then we get this idea of chitta-bhasa, which is a problem. The reason we say we bring in this idea of reflection is because of the sattva. Anything sattva, you can say, can reflect consciousness, or you can say it manifests consciousness. So when you use the idea of reflection, that's pratibimba. The bimba is the object, the pratibimba is the mirror, the reflection. So if you use that pratibimba, this chitta-bhasa comes in and say now the mind is turning toward the self, is it experiencing the reflection of the self? It's a good question. Is it experiencing the reflection of the self, or is it experiencing the self? We say it's experiencing the self because there is nothing but the self. Maya is mitya. That means any existence, any being, any consciousness that it enjoys is really only the Atma. There's not a real entity out there like a mirror, which is different than the self, to reflect the self. On the other hand, the mitya mind has sattva, rajas, and tamas. And in the sattva, the self seems to be manifest. In fact, in the Taittiriya and some other Upanishads, it said, you know, Bhagavan created the creation and then entered into it. It's not sequential like that, but he entered into it in the form of the jiva. So wherever the sattva is, the jivas, he as though entered in. So every jiva is saying, you know, I'm the conscious being, because they have the sattva mind. But the sattva mind, whether it's sattva, rajas, or tamas, or whatever it is, has no being other than the satchitatma. And so that mind, that if you take it to be kind of like, I'd say it's kind of like a mirror reflecting entity, what is reflecting, the mitya reflecting entity, is reflecting the atma. It's not turning in upon itself as though there's something there. There is nothing there for it to turn into, to resolve into. It's not going to resolve into itself. It resolves into its being. Its being is the Satchitatma. But it's confusing. So we use this avachedavada as to juxtapose one against the other. The avachedavada is like pot space. The self, yourself, is as though fills the mind like pot space. And then the other one is the pratibimbavada, which says it's like a reflection. So these two juxtaposed to against each other give the idea, one gives the idea of pervasion to the pervading the upadi, filling the upadi, like pot space, and the other gives the idea of reflecting the upadi. Neither is quite correct because of this question. Is there this chitta-bhasa wall between the buddhi's experience of the self? Is it experiencing the reflection of consciousness, or is it experiencing consciousness? Okay, so now we'll go to a little different level. Is my being the one that illumines the mind? And say if we accept this term, Chidambasa, Swamiji got rid of. He got rid of it 10 or 15 years ago because it brings in a unnecessary confusion. But anyway, we're going to work with it. So say your own being. You have your own being, and then you have the mind, the vrittis, which are known. Okay. So you can differentiate your own being, the me, in which we do differentiate it, from the vrittis, which are known. Okay. Why are the vrittis are known? Because they're sattva. They reflect consciousness. So there's a reflection in consciousness in the vritti. But that's a dangerous thing to say because you think of the sun shining in the water bucket or the reflecting in the mirror. You know, there's a reflection of the sun in the mirror. So am I that reflection? It's my experience of consciousness, that reflection. You say, no, that's the limitation of the drishtanta, of the illustration. Your self-experience is not a reflection. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then if your self-experience is a reflection, we have to merge that self-experience, which is reflected, into the self. But that isn't our experience. We don't experience a merging of a reflection, which is really not the self, into the self. Just like, say, if you have the reflection of your face in a mirror. I like this example, actually. Just imagine you're holding a mirror up to your face. Okay. Now, definitely you have a reflection of your face in the mirror. Okay. Now, where is the experience of yourself? You have the reflection of your face in the mirror. But where is the self-experience? It's in your face. It's not in the mirror. The mirror is jada. And jada means inert. And in this case, we'll say mitya for the creation. There is no experience of you, of your face in the mirror. There's a reflection of your face in the mirror. But not you. Mm. But not your face. You see what I mean? But there's your face. You're reflected in the mirror. And so now, what if we hold the mirror up to the sun? There's a reflection of the sun in the mirror. But is the sun in the mirror? No, it's not in the mirror. And if I move the mirror away, then, you know, the sun still remains as the sun, but the mirror is moved away. So now when we think of vrittis, I have a vritti has come. The vritti reflects consciousness. It enjoys knownness. It enjoys me. But what is my experience? The vritti is known, but where does my self-experience abide? There is no self-experience in the reflection. The reflection is only known. Now hold up the mirror to your face. There is the experience of your face, the reflection of your face, because the mirror reflects your face. It's a reflecting entity. But your experience of yourself is not in the reflection. So now think of the mirror as a vritti. Okay, so the vritti itself is known. Right? And so that reflecting capacity is there. It reflects consciousness, or it allows the vritti itself, the contents of the vritti, to be known. But where are you located? You're the experience of you, the thing that is actually there, is differentiated from the so-called reflection. The ahankara, when we recognize what we mean by ahankara, means I've identified me with whatever the nama rupa is in the reflection. When I've made that identification, you know, upon analysis, I recognize that no, actually, the buddhi vritti is objectified, and I remain as myself, always the same. This vritti goes, each vritti is known, each vritti enjoys consciousness. each vritti enjoys me, but when that vritti goes, I still am. So now there's another little complication there. There is nothing but me. Mm. There is nothing but consciousness. So the vritti takes place in consciousness because there is nothing but consciousness. And so even in that way, there's a little added thing here. Consciousness is pervasive to anything and everything because there's nothing away from it. Time and space itself exists in consciousness. It's mithya. There's not, if time and space belongs to the creation, right? It's objectifiable, and you can kind of prove that. Like if you go to deep sleep, there's no experience of time and space. It doesn't exist in the Atma. So time and space, if you dream the time, the space, and all of the objectivity. It all comes together. It all belongs to Maya. And so say time, space, objectivity exist as an incidental attribute to Brahman, to the self. That means that the reality is just non-dual Brahman. Non-dual Brahman means there's nothing outside of it. It's non-dual. There's nothing else. And that becomes really kind of it can crack your head open in a way. Because it is the only thing that is there, and it's free of time and space. So there's no borders. There's no space. There's just one non-dual me, and it's not big or small. It doesn't have anything to do with that. And so this Maya is a manifestation, incidental attribute, of non-dual me. So no matter what, the non-dual me, nothing is outside of it, because there is nothing outside of it. So now, no matter how big the space is, or how long the time, there is nothing other than non-dual me. It's not something you can escape, because it's not spatial. And so being me, the reality me, is ever-present everywhere. From the standpoint of the creation, from the standpoint of me, there's no everywhere, there's just me. And so now, in me, there is a vritti. Right? There's nothing but me, but now we have the Maya vritti, the mithya vritti. That mithya vritti, because of being sattva, itself feels the knownness. It is known. You experience the knownness, okay, because of the sattva. But the sattva vritti, oh, this is a good way. If you've done japa, the repetition of a mantra, okay. And so just hang on. This little example is to try to show you exactly what I mean. When you're doing the japa, you say Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. After you've done it for some time, there's Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, mantra, a silence. Mantra, silence. Mantra, silence. Right? But after you've done it for a while, the silence, the mantra starts taking place in silence. The silent being of your awareness. Right? So now it's not mantra, silence, mantra, silence. There's another level of silence in which the mantra, silence, mantra, silence, mantra, silence takes place in. That silence is my own being. It's the silent silence of awareness. Then you recognize because of the repetition of the mantra, which brings about a certain subtlety of mind, what you recognize is that mantra is taking place in you, and you are not doing anything, you're not knowing anything, you simply are. That becomes really what we call aparoksha. It becomes self-evident. The mantra is taking place, and each mantra is known, but there's nobody knowing it. There's nobody knowing it. I'm not knowing it. I'm not doing anything to know that mantra at all. I just simply am conscious being. And that conscious being is not performing an act of reflecting itself in the mantra. I simply am, and I am totally asanga from the mantra. and the mantra is known. But I am totally independent of that mantra. And so this, you know, the known mantras, it's like the known vrittis, the Om Namah Shivayas, you know, are floating through, each one known, but I am doing absolutely nothing to know it. It's just the consciousness of my being is the consciousness which the Mithya Mantra enjoys, and because I've quietened my mind deeply by the repetition of a mantra, you know, that kind of thins out your mind, so that makes your mind very subtle. The mind itself can differentiate itself in the form of mantra, 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 which is like vritti, 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 vritti. It's put in a situation where it becomes very, very obvious that yourself is not in any way even involved in the mantra, and the mantra is known. So if you want to say the mantra reflects consciousness or is pervaded by consciousness, it doesn't matter. The mantra is mithya, and it doesn't touch me in any way, because it has no being to touch me. I am the being. But when I'm doing that mantra, the absolute asangatvam means absolutely untouched. What's the word they use for sangha? Unattached. Untouched. Unattached to whatever vritti is taking place. And so it's not contributing to your being. A vritti is not contributing or taking away from the Atma. It's simply, because it's sattva, it is simply known. But it doesn't lose its mityatva. You know? And so it's not about a reflection of the self. The self is totally unattached. Like my face, when I look at my face in a mirror, there's no sangha, there's no attachment there at all. There's no relationship. But there's the face. The face is there because of the mirror. But the mirror also is mithya, is jada, is inert. Right? And so the jada mirror is not going to have an experience of consciousness. The experience of consciousness belongs to the consciousness. If you followed that, that was pretty good. But it's also really dense and terse. Is it good?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Good, okay. It is the appreciation that there is self-experience that doesn't need mind to be experienced. That's the appreciation. Not that it's experiencing the Chidabhasa. You recognize the asangatvam of the mind, the absolute of the self, the absolute freedom of the self. It's not dependent upon anything at all. And the reflection, the knownness of the Chidabhasa, there's no sangha, there's no attachment to that either. There's no identification of the self with that. That was good. Good question. Difficult.
Good answer.
Mm-hmm. Difficult question, though. That's why Swamiji gave up the Chidabhasa. Because it complicates things. Yeah.
Good problem.
Right, just really quick. Can you just define for me Aparoksha Jnanam and Aparoksha Jnanam?
Aparoksha Jnanam and Pratyaksha.
Protection.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But there's Pratyaksha Jnanam, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think I have them confused.
Okay. Okay. The word Aparoksha we use in terms of the type of, in terms of self-knowledge. So let me define these terms. The first one we're going to define is Pratyaksha. Pratyaksha means the direct, immediate knowledge as sense perception. So if I were to translate pratyaksha or pratyaksha jnanam, knowledge, if you say pratyaksha jnanam, knowledge which is gained through your sense perception, number one. And then there's also for pratyaksha jnanam, something what we call sakshi bhasya. Sakshi bhasya means that which is directly experienced by the mind, but it's not gained through pratyaksha. Pratyaksha means pratyaksha. The knowledge that you're gaining takes place directly from sense contact. So, like for instance, my eyes are contacting you, so it's a direct, immediate knowledge. Right? Like if I look at this, the sense organ is like my eyes see this. There's nothing else going on. My eyes are responsible for making a vritti, for creating this vritti. So this is called pratyaksha. It's direct, immediate knowledge. Sense perception. The other type, though, is called sakshi bhasya, where if I have an imagination, you know, I'm thinking about something, what we call active imagination, union, active imagination. I'm having a direct, immediate experience that's not born out of my sense perception, but it's born out of the capacities that my mind has. Like meditation would be sakshi bhasya. It's immediately, directly experienced by the witness. Experienced, illumined by the witness. Nothing in between. So of the six means of knowledge that we have, it is only this first one called sense perception that gives direct knowledge, direct immediate knowledge. The other five means of knowledge are called paroksha. Paroksha means it's away from sense perception, and so it's not going to be direct. And so an example of that, common example, is for inference, which is one of the other means of knowledge. The famous inference is, oh, look, I see smoke. There must be fire. And the reason for that is there's an invariable concomitance between fire and smoke. So it's not the other way around, between smoke and fire. If I see smoke and it really is smoke, then there's a fire. I can infer a fire. That's paroksha, because I don't see directly the fire, right? But it's called indirect knowledge. Paroksha is indirect knowledge because another step is involved beyond my sense perception. So we've got these two. The other five, we've got six means of knowledge. The one is pratyaksha. Sense perception is direct, immediate knowledge. The other five are paroksha. You don't actually see the object, but you can infer it or you can presume that it is there. You know, so there's a variety of different means of knowledge like that. So now we have two words. I think this is going to fulfill what you want. Okay. So we've got the pratyaksha, direct, immediate knowledge involving sense perception or illumining content in a vritti, like a meditative experience. Then we have paroksha, indirect knowledge. Now, this is a problem. I cannot be the object of pratyaksha, sense perception, right? Because I'm not an object to be known through sense perception. Even sakshi bhasya, that which is illumined by the witness, is not going to work because we're talking about an objectification of the mind, like a meditative experience or a fantasy or whatever that the mind can do. That objectification is illumined directly by the sakshi, but I'm the sakshi, right? So that also doesn't give direct immediate knowledge. So self-knowledge can't be gained by pratyaksha, because it really involves sense perception. It can't be gained by paroksha, indirect knowledge, because I'm here. Right, so this can't be direct knowledge of something else, which the sense organs give me, and it can't be indirect knowledge, you know, because here I am. So we say, okay, it's not the atma jnanam, self-knowledge, is not gained by pratyaksha, sense perception. It's not gained by paroksha, indirect knowledge. It's gained by aparoksha. It's aparoksha jnanam. Paroksha means indirect. The a negates it. It's gained by a knowledge which is not indirect. Mm-hmm. Paroksha is indirect. negates the paroksha. Aparoksha, aparoksha, no, not indirect. It's not pratyaksha, it's not paroksha, mm-hmm. it's aparoksha. It's something other than these two. Mm-hmm. It's kind of neat.
So aparoksha jnanam
means not indirect knowledge. Because the see, that's the thing, that the normal way that we gain knowledge is through these six pramanas, that six means of knowledge that we have, but the means of knowledge that we have are either the direct knowledge, subject-object relationship in terms of the world, sense perception, or knowledges that are based upon sense perception, like inference or a presumption. Example for a presumption would be, I wake up in the morning and everything is completely wet. And so I presume that it rained last night. Because, you know, what else could do that? It's sunny out now, but everything is wet. There's puddles all over. So I presume, I'm not experiencing the rain, but there's an invariable relationship between that situation. Nothing else can account for that situation. So that becomes a means of knowledge. But these are indirect, because I'm not experiencing the rain. I'm presuming that it rained, because nothing else could cause that situation. See what I mean? So these means of knowledge are, if you say just sense perception, I'm not an object that I can look at, you know? And all of the other means of knowledge depend upon sense perception. And so how do I know myself? Right? The way I'm used to knowing has to do with objectifying my object, objectifying something, having a subject-object relationship with something. But what about when I'm a subject? So the means of knowledge that the pramana of the Upanishads does not give pratyaksha jnanam, it does not give paroksha jnanam, it gives aparoksha jnanam. Right? It gives a direct, immediate knowledge of myself that cannot be gained through perception. Pratyaksha. Now you can.
Can I just ask you one definition question, though? Mm-hmm. When you say pratyaksha, are you defining this direct immediate knowledge as a sense perception?
Yes.
It has to be as a sense perception. It can't just be.
No, there's two. The pratyaksha means it comes in the vicinity of the senses so that you have a direct knowledge, direct immediate knowledge. There's nothing intervening. So if I look at this, there's nothing intervening. My sense organs land on this, creating a vritti, which is illumined by the witness, by the sakshi. Okay. There's also direct, immediate knowledge of states of mind, like emotions.
That's also protection.
Yeah.
Oh, because imagination.
It's a subset of protection called sakshi bhasya. That which is illumined directly by the sakshi. And so actually, all of the means of knowledge that create a vritti are sakshi bhasya. All of them are all of those means of knowledge, all of the vrittis are illumined by the sakshi. But here, we're using it only in reference to this particular means of knowledge. Even though sakshi bhasya is pervasive, here it has to do with the direct relationship between the sakshi and a vritti that is generated, such as an emotion, imagination, a meditative state, you know, that's not dependent on sense perception. But still, the relationship between that experience and the self, the sakshi, has nothing in between it. As in an inference, you see the smoke, you don't see the fire, but you know that there's an invariable concomitance between those two, smoke and fire. And so you can infer and gain knowledge that there is fire there, even though you don't see it. See what I mean? So those are all called indirect knowledge.
Yeah.
Self isn't going to be indirect knowledge. Mm-hmm.
Is Shruti a pramana that gives both aparoksha
and paroksha?
And paroksha?
Yes, because, for instance, the first part of the Vedas are considered also, you know, a pramana. But they're a pramana for indirect knowledge because it's really dealing with what's going on in samsara. You know, and so say all the lokas, that's indirect knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Reincarnation is indirect knowledge. you know, it can make all kinds of sense and be logically solid and everything fits into place, but you don't have a direct immediate experience of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but here in this world where we are right now within our own prarabdha karma, whether we're talking about the nature of the Atma, the self, or the nature of the sukshma sharira, in terms of descriptive, describing that, what we're describing is here to be experienced, and we're talking about the world is here. Right? And so that gives direct, immediate knowledge, and especially in reference to the self.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Initially, when we sit in the class, there's, you know, there comes a time when the mind sort of says, you know, the teaching is, the vision is just so clear that the mind comes and says, now, how can I ever think that I'm not the whole? But as soon as we step out of the room, bang, as though it is gone. But there comes a time where this knowledge and this vision sort of stays with the mind all of the time, that even when the mind is sort of in a distress state or whatever.
Yeah.
And my definition of the word nishtha, that knowledge is sort of firm, is clear, and is constant, no matter what the mind is sort of
what's
experiencing.
Going on. Yeah.
So what I would like to, could you just elaborate how this process comes when the knowledge and the vision is only when the teacher is willing the pramana, to the time where that knowledge and vision is always here in the mind.
Everybody online, I do see Annalisa, especially you. I do see your questions, but I will get to them after I finish what we're doing right here. So just hang on there. What we're talking about right now. I got a little sidetracked by this. Can you just tell me briefly again?
Okay. Initially, this vision and knowledge is only available to the mind when the teacher is willing the pramana.
Right.
Eventually, this knowledge and vision will be with the mind always.
Right.
So can you just elaborate on the process, how it sort of comes about?
The antakarna shuddhi, you know, the learning different attitudes, karma yoga attitude and all those things, go along with the gaining of this vision. But both of them help each other. So say, for instance, you didn't know anything about karma yoga or raga dvesha and how to neutralize those raga dveshas. You hadn't really learned too much about that. You're just really basically getting the vision. That will take your mind a long ways, because the problem that we have as jivas, the root of it is ajnana, is self-ignorance. But what causes the most problems to the mind is raga dvesha, is our likes and dislikes. And I like to say these likes and dislikes, I call it the desire template. I need this so that I can be happy. So that need to be happy, I don't mean ha-ha happy. Mm-hmm. I mean that fullness, that wholeness where all is well with me, that kind of strength, you know. That's what I need that. And until I have self-knowledge, that is something that I have to gain from the world. You know, maybe if I get, you know, the proper partner and I have a good job and my kids are great or whatever, all of these things we think, and we start collecting them and then exchanging them, all these kind of things, you know, try to get the right combination to make me happy. But the thing, it never ends.
Mm-hmm.
It never ends, because even if I get what I really want, then after some time I don't want that, and that thing that I used to want is still around. Garage sale.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So So we realize, you know, that this is just not going to work. But until we realize it on many different levels of subtlety, there's some little niggling thing. It's like a habitual ajnanam, habitual behavior, habitual ignorant behavior, that I need this to be happy. And Kringpi gets just uncannily subtle, raga dvesha. And slowly but surely, those things, as the knowledge becomes clear and I recognize more and more myself, the mind loves to be with the self. And this is all fine, but the satisfaction of the wholeness is with my own being. And so being with, because the ananda, because what I've been seeking for in the world is really hidden in my own self. But this recognition, the reality of this, takes place over time, because our whole orientation, totally, the entire mind was set differently. It was set to gather that wholeness, do things, accomplish things in order to gain that wholeness or that happiness. And there's a lot of misery also in just the pressure of thinking that you have to do this and do that and get this and get that so that maybe you'll be happy. And continual shock when you get the thing and the happiness lasts for a few seconds, like 15 seconds or 30 seconds, and then you're just back. You know, because you've got like a little samadhi moment, a little from the fulfillment of a desire, because at that moment your mind is desireless. Just like clean ananda, beautiful ananda. But it's fake. You know? It you're tricked. You're tricked by the satisfaction, the attainment of the desire that gives the shantavritti. You feel so much wholeness and so much love and so much everything that you could ever want. You know, because of the, especially big desires that come true, you feel that because of the degree of what you call shanti, that in that moment of fulfillment, where at that time you got what you wanted, you didn't want anything. So there's a lot of absorption there. But it's quick to go, because something else will quickly arise in your mind, like, yeah, but I could lose this, or, you know, yeah, but this is one that used to just shock the heck out of me. It would be like, I would accomplish something that I thought was important for my happiness, and I would get it in 15 seconds, or 20 maybe. It's something like, yeah, but I need this too. You know? Just boom, just like that. It didn't even give me 20 seconds. So shocking, you know?
It feels kind of a little bit complex in that you're a psychotherapist, so you're familiar with the term corrective emotional experience.
Yeah.
So, you know, supplying missing experiences or corrective experiences, and that can be healing.
It can be very healing if it's done as inner child work. That's very, very healing. That is a really an emotionally corrective experience. I don't really see. I don't know. I have to think about
it. I hear what you're saying, but I think there can be so much agitation in one's psychology through that it make it even hard to even just chill out and be in a room like this, and their mind is available to a teacher, you know.
That's true, but what we're talking about now, say you're a mumukshu, at least for Jagadish's question, say you're a mumukshu, you really gained this knowledge, you know, but you don't have what we call nishta, that nishta where the knowledge is very, very firm and your mind doesn't run out and I need this to be happy. There has to be a conversion. This is so beautiful in the chapter 3 of the Gita. There has to be a conversion from what we call a binding desire and a non-binding desire. Because desires aren't going to go away. But if the desire is not binding, if you don't get your way, you're still fine. Mm-hmm. If it's binding, then you really suffer. So it's not that you're going to lose all desires, but the desires themselves become mitya, which means that your own, the wholeness of your own self is where the mind is rooted, you know, mm-hmm. into the ananda of your own self. And you still have these desires, but they're mitya, they're non-binding. Means, okay, if I don't get it, that's okay, you know. But those non-binding desires, the non-binding desires keep growing and growing and growing and growing in the sense that the desires that you have become more and more and more and more non-binding. But there's still these binding desires which rise up and they kind of can kind of catch you off guard, you know? But over time, as you're with this knowledge and you're alert, you know, then those kind of desires start to drop off. The desire doesn't drop off, the binding nature of the desire drops off. And then you have nishtha, because there's no real agitation in your mind. You didn't get your way, doesn't really matter. And that's true on a lot of levels, like, I don't want it to matter. You know, I don't have any interest at all in having a binding desire. I don't want to suffer like that. If I would even get the whiff of that, oh no. I don't need that. I don't want that. I don't want to live like that. You get so your great preference is to just enjoy Ishvara. But that's a growing preference as you realize more and more that you don't want the binding desires. So one thing I think is helpful in terms of, what do you call, facilitating this nishtha is to, instead of just using nishtha as Swamiji initially for 20 or 30 years used it, was clarity. Mm-hmm. Clarity in this knowledge. He changed that the last 5 or 6 years or so into commitment. That you have a commitment to this knowledge. And why I like that word is because that nishtha applies to the mumukshu. The commitment to the knowledge is there. And so that means that when my mind is acting in a way or say that the dharmas aren't, I'm being a dharmic or I'm being unkind and my mind is lacking in maturity in this way and that way. That doesn't mean I don't know myself, but this way of behaving is not an expression of my knowledge. It's an expression of some leftover ignorance, right? You know, and so if I have nishtha, I'm actually committed to working on that. Because it's really not a reflection of my knowledge, it's just habitual. Mm-hmm. Or habitual hurts, or habitual ways of reacting, you know. And those ways are not really meaningful anymore. And they certainly don't contribute to your shanti. And so therefore they become sadhana. Because they're not helpful. It really is not helpful. Like I can be unkind sometimes, but that, there's nothing helpful about that. I would be much better off if I had been kind in that situation or caring in that situation. But maybe I was irritated. That irritation, if I was irritated, not only will the other person suffer the irritation, I'm also experiencing the irritation. If I'm angry, the other person gets the brunt of the anger, but so do I. It's not like your anger is like an arrow that just leaves you and now you're free of the anger. No. If you're angry at somebody, you're also experiencing the anger. If you hate somebody, you're experiencing the hatred. If you're unkind to somebody, you're experiencing that unkindness. And so it's not to your advantage to have these type of habitual qualities. And yet, because we've had beginningless lifetimes of desire, desire creates hurt and pressure in your mind. Because any desire that you have, binding desire, not only is there the stress of fulfilling that, I need this to be happy, that's the binding desire, I must have this to be happy. That itself is stressful. Okay, so the instant it rises, it's stressful. It's a bad trip from the instant it rises, actually. But there's more to it than that. This universe, this loka, is not set up in such a way that your desires are, as you have a desire, it's fulfilled. It's not set up that way. So it's set up with lots of obstacles. So here's the desire, the thing I really want. And then there are the people that help me get that. And then there's the people that don't help me get that. There are my friends and there are my enemies. You know? I feel inimical to the people that are working against me in fulfilling my desire. And I feel like very loving and friendly and respectful toward the people that help me fulfill that desire. And so there's like triple stress. All kinds of, the desire itself, binding desire, causes all kinds of stress and agitation and unkindness and irritation and anger and frustration. All of these things, you know, are kind of the threads that are hanging off of the desire. And actually, you can feel it when it, as soon as it arises, the stress arises, if it's binding. Now, with knowledge, you can have non-binding desire because you're very, very clear, you know, that the source of ananda is your own being, and your buddhi enjoys that being. And so non-binding desires become more and more and more non-binding because you don't want to deal with the problems that they bring. They just bring so many problems. It's so nice to not have them. And that's what you go on discovering. It's just much better, much nicer life, honestly, to appreciate Ishwara Srishti. Because your upadhi also is more of a manifestation of Ishwara Srishti rather than Jiva Srishti. When the Jiva Srishti is the Jiva's creation, like what's coming out of your own mind, your own imagination, when the Jiva Srishti is superimposed on the Ishwara Srishti, that is really problematic. Because your Jiva Srishti is your own imagination. Ishwara might have quite a different plan, you know? But when you're not bothering with your own desires, but rather being present to what is, there's so much freedom in that. There's so much freedom because the only way you can really do that anyway is as you recognize your own ananda. That's where you can do that fully. So it's just it's a growth process. That's why the example of just, you know, be patient, go into Ishwara's time and let the flower unfold of your clarity, of your nishta. You know, let your knowledge unfold and just enjoy that process. It doesn't happen overnight. You might have a lot of clarity, but your mind, all different levels and layers of your mind and your unconscious have to come to consciousness in the light of that knowledge. And that takes some time. You can just enjoy that. Especially, you know, the nicer your mind becomes, the nicer it becomes. You know? Does that help?
Oh, tremendous.
Yeah. Patience is the key word.
Yeah, because the Jiva Srishti can sort of become catastrophic also.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because it's you just making it up. Yeah. So much better to slow down into Ishwara's time. Ishwara is slow moving compared to the mind. Your mind sees how it's supposed to go right away. It goes all the way to the end. And Ishwara could take 1 or 2, 3 years to get there. Really?
Like this farm.
Yeah, like this farm. Mm-hmm. You have to enjoy being here as it is and watch it improve and watch things come together. It's really beautiful. And that's happening too.
Mm-hmm.
It's just naturally at Ishwara's pace.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just keeps getting more and more beautiful and more at home and more the things that we need. But you can just enjoy that unfolding of this farm, and we don't know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. Mm-hmm. We'll see. Here we are. Yeah. But we can be with it. We can be present to it and enjoy it. It's happening for us anyway.
Here we are.
Here we are. Yeah. It's amazing. Okay, let's look at these questions here. I'll see if I can still see your questions on this. Let me try on here, going down to the... Oh yeah, when I was talking about Anantanand Rambachan, who wrote the Limits of Scripture. He's at St. Olaf College. I think you'd have to get that book. I don't know if it's still in print, but I have it. It's a really good book. I don't think right now, Annalisa, when you say, I love this, it's so helpful to think about the sun in the mirror. That had to do with one of the questions that we got in the satsang. Whether I'm actually experiencing the chittabhasa when I turn the buddhi turns toward the self, or I'm experiencing the self. So that was a discussion of that question. I think the verses were on like 17, 18, 19, and 20, I think. Can you explain the relationship between Mahavakya Aham Brahmasmi and Aparoksha Jnanam? The Mahavakyas are the essence, called the Tatparya, of the Upanishads. A Mahavakya shows the identity of the Jiva with Ishvara, or the identity of the self with Brahman. That the self that you are is limitless consciousness, is Brahman. Or the self that you are is the self that Ishvara is. So this is, in just three words, basically, the whole essence of the Upanishad, okay? This knowledge. The pramanas, the means of knowledge, are prakriyas to take the mind to the recognition of that truth. Because that truth of myself is not something that can be objectified and then therefore known in terms of a subject-object relationship, and yet it is still directly and immediately known, we say it is aparoksha jnanam. It is not indirect. It's a direct, immediate knowledge. So the wielding of all of the prakriyas really resolve in knowledge of the Mahavakya, the identity between the Jiva and Ishvara. That's what it is. And the that knowledge that you gain is called aparoksha jnanam. Annalisa says, I don't remember, know exactly when she said this, but Pooja Swamiji was so fascinated by the American garage sale.
Yes.
Yeah, because it's such a perfect Drishtanta illustration. Right? You've bought all these things. These all things were important, and now you can't wait to have the garage sale to get rid of them all. And I'll even give them away a dollar 50 cents.
And it moves around in the same neighborhood, which is something used to say.
Yeah. Maria says, "Thank you for reminding me about patience in Ishvara's time." That's a biggie. That's so helpful. To recognize, to go into Ishvara's time. Slow down.
Bharat and I were talking about that sort of like, especially when you're caught in the traffic jam.
Yeah, that's a good one. Call the user too. Is that you? Is that you, Tata? I have my I wouldn't be able to see your message because I had the phone off. Hi, Jackie. You've been talking. We miss you here.
Yeah.
You and David and little mister. Hi, Maria. Hi, Michael. Hi, Steve. Hi, everybody. Mm-hmm. Jackie says, miss everyone, too.
Is she hoping to be here?
Don't think. Jackie, are you going to drop by? Hi, Michael. She says, on my drone. Nice. We'll be waiting.
We'll be waving.
And Jackie can relax. Yeah.
Lana Lisa says, I'm still wanting more illumination between Aham Brahmasmi and Aparoksha Jnanam. There seems to be a very close connection to that specific Mahavakya. No, I don't think it's a close connection to that specific Mahavakya. I think Aparoksha Jnanam is actually the label for the type of knowledge that the Upanishad gives, because the self is already self-evident. And so it's all the experience is already there. And so the prakriyas have to actually take away from disrobe the self in a way, you know, leaving yourself. So that the self that it leaves you with is gained through aparoksha jnanam, that which is not an indirect knowledge, and it's also not a knowledge which is where the self is gained through an experience, objectifiable experience. Hmm. 9:30.
That was pretty much the same as the answer to the question at the very beginning, too. That was intellectual, that's kind of indirect knowledge, or can I experience it? That's direct knowledge, and it's neither one. It's not indirect knowledge.
Yes, mm-hmm. Aparoksha, perfect. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right, Annalisa. If you say Aham Brahmasmi, if you recognize that, that is aparoksha jnanam. The trees, Jackie asks, how are the trees? Mm. Well, that's a story. Anna. I'll just tell you quickly.
We were on such a high note. It was so good.
Yeah. Anna got turned back at the border. They didn't let her into the country. Very weird. But she'll come next year. We're going to make it sure that it's... We don't quite know how that happened. It was a very strange event. But she'll come next year. We have to plan for that properly. Yeah, wow, it's right. But we've done, you know, we've done a lot of work here, a lot of really wonderful things, but we miss her, and the trees will be waiting, because we didn't do any pruning.
We can do a little bit.
Mm. We can do a little bit. We have a week to do it. I don't know. I've lost my heart for the pruning. We need to do it, though. Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
It's really necessary. Maybe we'll get inspired and have a pruning day. Mm-hmm. Marjorie can lead us.
The dead things in the water sprouts go straight up.
Yes.
I know.
Yeah.
And the suckers on the
trunks. Yeah. The suckers are easy for us to get.
Yeah,
the other ones are hard.
To hatch it.
because they are going straight up.
Yeah.
And they're high because the trees have grown so much.
So we have to use the ladder. Ben said that we use the ladder that fastens.
Yeah.
Step up.
Yeah.
But still, it's pretty high. Someone.
Maybe we have to hire someone. That's what I do.
Did we get a chance?
Because we don't have it. Huh?
Did we get a chance?
No.
Okay.
No.
We've got five chainsaws on our property, and I use them.
Well, I might let you use one. I'm scared of chainsaws.
I have one you can have.
I don't want one on the property.
With you?
Oh, no chainsaws. I think they're just too dangerous. I mean, if somebody really has experience, they're awful.
You can get the electric ones. They're quite cool.
Yeah. No chainsaws. I know. He can do it. Jagadish can do it because he's a chainsaw guy. He can do it. But unless a person has had a lot of experience, I just don't want a person using a chainsaw here without a lot of experience with it. Too many awful things have happened. I have a chainsaw in my mind.
Don't think of a chainsaw.
Don't think of eggplant eggs and tomatoes. Om Swasti Pajabhyat Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Ko Brahmanevya Shivamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Kritihi Sasya Shalini Desho yam shobarahitaha brahmana santu nirbhayaha om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha sarve santu niramayaha sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kaschit dukkha bhat bhavet asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritangamaya Om purnamadav purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate Purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om Om Tat Sat.